It's Wednesday, December 19th, 2007, and you're listening to episode 83 of Fear the Boot, a show about tabletop role-playing games and a little bit more. Running time for this episode is 50 minutes. Welcome to Fear the Boot. My name is Dan.
My name is Luke.
My name is Adam.
My name is Joe.
And Joe, we have with us as a guest host, kind of like how we had Keith Curtis last time, because Joe is something of an expert in the area we are talking about today, which is designing modules for Conplay. And Joe, do you want to rattle off that list of qualifications you have and experience you've got with cons? Because it's pretty lengthy.
It's the only thing lengthy about them.
I am the former director of Living Kingdoms of Kalamar. I'm the former regional triad for the Divers region, which is Missouri, Iowa, Kansas, and Nebraska. I've written 27 events for the RPGA. I'm currently writing my last adventure and the regional conclusion for Divers, a three-round interactive that will be hosted at its last convention. It's an all-day event on Sunday. I've also organized four major conventions and two additional cross-regional conventions with our neighbors in Illinois and Indiana, the total attendance of which was over 1,000 people across all six conventions.
You are also on our forums, and your username is NH Rider, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so if anyone wants to look you up or has more questions relating to this episode, or if you just wade into the middle of the conversation, the episode review, NH Rider is the guy that we are talking to right now. Before we get into today's topics, I want to do two shout-outs, one to Craig Pierce, who was kind enough to send Fear the Boot a Christmas package, which consisted of dice sets that are in the Fear the Boot colors, which is especially nice for Luke.
Yeah, I can't thank him enough. This restarts my dice collection after Festivus Con destroyed it. So I now have dice again. I guess I'm officially a gamer once again. Thank you, Craig. You've really touched me in an appropriate place. No, but seriously, thank you. This is awesome.
And I also want to send a shout out to Condurian. I think I'm pronouncing this right. And that's his name on Eve. That's not his real name. I have no idea what his real name is. But I was talking to him, or he was trying to talk to me on Eve today. I was on there dorking around a little bit. And in the middle of the conversation, I just walked off because I was taking a phone call in a minor medical emergency. So I am sorry for blowing you off and just wanted to give a quick shout out to say hey. And I will try and catch you online again at some point.
He is Rip Steak Face on the forums.
Rip Steak Face. Okay, so
there's a story there that he must tell.
And I'm guessing that's not his real name either.
Wait. So now we're using the beginning of the episodes for personal apologies instead of Fear the Boot apologies. All
that's
right.
Not an apology. It's a shout out. It's a greeting. It's a hey,
no,
hello.
It was an apology.
I'm sorry I hung up on you.
Hey, you know what? We should never talk about why we're having so many guest hosts. Are we just getting lazier in our old age?
Well, it's not. I don't think it's that. It's because two particular jackasses, and I won't use John or Tex's name, keep blowing off these recordings.
Luke did challenge on the forums to a feat of strength, which I pointed out to him that I had destroyed him many a times at Worms Armageddon. 2 days later, here I am.
That's not a feat of strength. Worms Armageddon is a feat of the mind, brother.
Uh-huh.
Feats of strength mean pinning me. Like at Festivus.
Right. Are you guys done comparing sizes?
Yeah.
Up your pants.
One more quick thing. Fear the Con is now open for registration. You can sign up. You can buy your tickets. You can sign up for games. And we will link that in the show notes. So if you are coming down to Fear the Con March 8th, and we hope you are, then please be sure to stop by and sign up. Or if you're interested in running a game, then be sure to send an email to luke@feartheboot.com.
Yeah, especially if you're interested in running a game. I've got a good stock of GMs, but we need more. Because right now, I won't say with the pre-reg open today, we lost almost all. Well, we didn't lose. We happily gained players for almost all of our host slots. So we need more GMs, and we might be running more games, too, if it comes down
right
to it. We'll see what happens.
What? Maybe we should put out some sort of ridiculous challenge that people have to overcome, and at that point, I would run a game for you, Luke.
Pin me. Somebody has to pin me, and you'll run a game.
I've got an HD camcorder upstairs, so we could record this.
Record
this feat of Greco-Roman wrestling.
Why would I? I don't want to wrestle him to.
He doesn't want to run a game.
I don't want to run a game, but I would run a game if the listeners overcame some Herculanean feat.
Like pinning Luke.
Well,
okay.
Obviously, it would have to be something that more than one person could participate in and
I will
across
travel.
The country.
I will travel.
We'll just send Luke around in a UPS package.
Buffing out.
Like
hey!
That one little fat kid that did that several years ago. First topic up for today. Game masters that don't know the subject they are game mastering. And Adam, did you want to give the example that kicked this discussion off?
Not really.
Okay.
Do it anyway.
Fantastic.
I will.
You don't have to use names.
I won't.
Okay.
Have you ever played in a game where the game master is doing something that is something they are unfamiliar with, but you have too much knowledge in? Like, in a couple games that we've played, we started doing hacking, and it's like, this is not even close. I can't get past the fact that I have real-world experience with this
right.
to even attempt to do this in a fictional setting.
Yeah.
Kind of like the preview for that new movie. They've hacked my car.
Yeah, that's ridiculous. But they've hacked my car!
Oh, no, your clock's been reset.
That just happened.
Since your car's wired to the internet and all. But, you know, I don't even just see this in role-playing games, but, like, my mom's worked in the operating room for decades, and she has trouble watching medical shows because they all drive her nuts. Kind of like, oh, what was that movie with Sylvester Stallone and several years ago where he was...
Wesley Snipes? Come on,
No, Demolition Man was pretty good.
Yeah, what?
The Specialist or something like that?
No.
Where he logs in to, like, a BBS for assassins, and it even has, like, a little, like, ASCII machine gun that comes up.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
It's horrible. That's
the one with him and Antonio Banderas?
No, it was him and the lady from Basic Instinct.
Sharon Stone?
Yeah, Sharon Stone.
Ooh.
Yeah, I thought Antonio was trying to kill him in that movie to become the next big assassin.
Yes.
Okay, well, whatever the movie was, it was terrible in its representation of computers.
Yes.
CSI has been terrible in its representation of optometry and how to use an ophthalmoscope. As they do so from 10 to 12 feet away, when you need to get
CSI
right on top of
it. CSI's been terrible about CSI.
Good point.
Yeah, actually, if you're really interested in following that kind of stuff, there's a better show, I believe, on A&E called The First 48 that follows an actual crime lab as they try to solve murders.
Unfortunately, I've watched it. It's nowhere near as entertaining as CSI.
No, it's not as entertaining. I think it's less entertaining but more interesting.
There's
but the point here being
A&E.
That playing under...
yeah, exactly.
I think at some point we've all played under a game master who tried to game master in great detail a subject that he or she did not know all that much about, or we as the players knew more about.
Yeah, this is an awesome point as a player where you accept the game master doesn't know about this. I am absolutely fine with abstraction.
Yeah, don't get pedantic about it.
Yes,
because it'll just slow the game down and make everybody mad at you.
Well, here's the question, though. Whose problem is it? Is the player's problem or the game master's problem?
It's everybody's problem.
Well, yeah, it depends. If they speak up, it's everybody's. It's usually just the players. Because who can expect the GM to know everybody about everything about everybody's specialty? Like, I can't expect somebody I'm playing with to know a lot about medicine or optometry or even, you know, life sciences. So
right.
I accept that. Unless we're playing mage, where that information comes in really, really handy. Because, oh, well, I can just do this. You have E. coli in your colon. I'm going to make that flesh-eating.
One of the reasons that I would pin this back on the GM rather than the players, I think the players, they can become rules lawyers or setting lawyers or whatever. They can become pedantic about this. But I kind of pin it back on the GM because if you don't know an area that well, don't dig into it. I mean, this is what George Lucas is consistently guilty of. He knows nothing about something, so he just goes into greater and greater detail and leaves it to the poor follow-up writers and fan community to try and come up with some kind of apologetic explaining how a parsec is actually a...
Look, do you have another example other than the Kessel Run?
The lightsaber.
Okay, no. You are completely wrong on this. Look, he included the lightsaber. It may not make any sense at all, but it is damn cool.
Well, right, but then he tried to explain it.
Yeah, you shouldn't try to explain stuff.
That's
like
what
that.
I just said.
No, that's fine.
If you don't know, just leave it abstracted. There's a lightsaber. Here's what it does. It works. How does it work? I'm not a physicist, I'm not going to try and define
this. Who's at fault here? The guy who put it out there or the guy who said, well, how does it work?
Well, when Lucas offers an explanation,
we'll keep this at the table there, Longhair. Come on.
If I'm like, shoot yourself in the foot, then you shoot yourself in the foot.
I don't think he offered an explanation for the Kessel Run. I think people asked, and then people bitched.
I think you're probably right on that. How deep do you want to dig to somebody who doesn't know anything, who will come up with something that's completely wrong and not care? How deep do you want to dig? That's what I'm asking you
right
now.
All right, well, see, at least I'm trying to offer solutions here. So what's your solution?
Be quiet.
Yeah, let it go.
Let it go. It's not a big deal. It's a game. You can't expect a simulation of, oh, I'm going to do surgery now, so let's go ahead and go through the 25-step process. I expect you to know everything about this as a GM, by the way.
Yeah, I don't think any GM...
If we're not playing ER the game, you know, I mean, if we are playing ER the game, then, well, maybe you should, but still.
As a player, if you had to sit down at a table where a GM was very blatantly walking into a field you're proficient in, and for this case, we'll just say we're role-playing optometry. No idea why.
It's the most boring game ever.
Exactly. Doing it one or two, horribly, one horribly or two. Wrong. Could you literally just sit there and say, oh, it's just a game, not a problem?
I could to a point. The point where it becomes a problem is if I try to do something I know would work in the real world,
uh-huh.
and they tell me, no, I can't for some reason. That would be wrong. But if we're just talking about you're doing optometry wrong, no big deal. It's a game. Let's just do it. Let's get over it.
That's exactly what.
Why are we doing optometry in a game? I do this every day. Can I blow something up, please?
Right.
Mr. GM?
And that's exactly what I just said, just in different words, that you're better off abstracting, keeping it at the high level. And I think part of it's important because, let's face it, that there's a certain suspension of disbelief in a role-playing game. Obviously, a role-playing game departs from reality in some way, or maybe in many ways. But they are still fundamentally linked to reality in some way, okay? In a sword and sorcery game, swords are still forged out of iron by a blacksmith and so on and so forth. And we rely on that real-world knowledge to understand the game. That I understand if somebody draws a gun and shoots me, it will hurt me. Well, where did I gain this understanding from? Well, I gain it from the real world that guns hurt people. And once again, I think there's a borderline here where you can become so pedantic and so nitpicky and so just childish about the whole thing that you're not giving the GM any breaks. The GM suddenly has to have 18 PhDs or they're not allowed to run anything. But on the flip side, I think the GMs need to accept, okay, I don't know that much about this stuff, and kind of steer around those areas, or heck, learn something. Do a little research before the game and learn a little something about it.
There's nothing wrong with hand-waving as long as nobody's going to be at fault based on the information you gave them. If you gave out bad information they acted on, and they call you on it, yeah, you screwed up. But if you give out bad information that's just bad information that has no real consequence,
right?
No big deal.
Yeah, I've played in games in the past where there were so many suspensions of disbelief. There was so much corner cutting. There were so many departures from reality that at one point in the campaign, I just pretend said, okay, I flap my arms and fly away. Like, well, you can't do that. I'm like, why not? All this other ridiculous crap is going on. It's like everything else that shouldn't work does work. Why can't I just flap my arms and fly away?
Let me say that there is a very cool flip side to this. When I was running Renegade Horizon, I have a whole setting full of airships and various ways this works. And I kind of explained, I have enough explanation to justify it without going into any real detail because I don't want to. It's really not important. But I had a game full of engineers. Iron Herjar was there, Super Duck from the forums, and they go, well, actually, given what you've told us, we can figure out how this works for you and put it together. And like within 10 minutes, they're like, this is how it's done. This works perfectly. I'm like, that's really cool. I need to keep you guys around. Thank you for making my game way better.
That's a positive outcome. It's like we've said several times on the show, when you sit down to game, this is not a competition between parties. You are a team working together to have a good game. And everybody's a part of this team. The game master, the players, the wife upstairs who wants you to hold it down are all part of the team that you've got to have on board to make a good game. So I agree with you that, I mean, draw on the expertise of the people in your game. Yeah, I've done that before in games where I get to an area I don't know, and I'll turn to somebody and say, look, how would that work out? You know, does this guy... And this assumes you trust the player, and they're not just going to say, oh, yeah, of course that works.
Well, you can usually tell if they're going to play that. Kind of on that same topic. I mean, if I'm running a game that I know okay, but I know there's people who are there great, I'll ask some system questions. If I don't know how to do, like, Joe, I was running a Eberron campaign for Joe and a bunch of other guys who played D&D way more than I did. I'd kind of gotten back in, and I knew the basics, but all the little detailed stuff, I would go, okay, help me out here, guys. And they were excellent at it and helped me, and we had a much better game for it. And by, you know, watching once or twice, I learned and never had to ask again. And the game ended after two sessions, so I didn't have to ask ever again.
At the same time, though, we also asked you to run Tour of Darkness. And you outright refused because you knew your knowledge of military and military tactics would just be subpar.
I think Sean and I both refused for that same reason.
But I want to play.
But we don't know the military. We don't know how to make military games, you know, fun. Especially for a campaign that lasts like 12 years of real time. So it's like, anyway. Now we're getting very specific.
I've done that, though. I've declined games because I'm not prepared to run them, whether it's information or even...
If a GM is unprepared and he knows there are players expecting him to achieve a particular level of proficiency, he should just simply say, I'm not capable of running this game for you. And either the players go find someone who is, or the player who's so proficient step up and GM himself.
This is why I won't run a Call of Cthulhu game. Because, first of all, I know there are people in my group of players that know a lot more about the Lovecraft mythos than I do. And the second reason is because I would have real trouble personally running a game where the good guys lose. That I'm one of those people, if I run a Cthulhu game, it's going to end 6 months in with an A-bomb killing Cthulhu. It's just the way I want to run my games. And so for that reason, the lack of knowledge and the lack of, I don't know, ability to conduct that kind of genre, I've just stepped down from a couple requests to run Cthulhu games.
Adam, what kind of games do you refuse to run?
Most games.
I thought that would be the answer. What if somebody wanted to play Tron? You're a programmer. You should know all about Tron.
I've never even seen Tron.
You'd still be an expert because you're a programmer. It's all about programming.
On my bike.
It's like The Matrix 1982.
That's not even funny. I'm cutting that out.
That's fine. It was kind of long and dumb. Wait. Now you have to cut it out.
No, trust me, I would have anyway. Don't worry about it.
So, designing modules for convention play. This is on our minds right now because we've got Fear the Con coming up here in, what, about less than 3 months? 2 months, 3 weeks, something like that. I don't know. Luke's blinking and staring. He's no better at calendar math than I am. So
3 months.
Yeah.
Let's go.
About 3 months away. And all of us, with the possible exception of Adam, are going to be running at least one game there. And I will have to openly admit, I have been running games for almost 20 years now. This is the first time I will ever run a game at a convention. And secondly, on top of that, this is the first time that I will have ever run an intentional non-comedy game one-shot. I've run some comedy game one-shots, but I have never tried to run a serious game that's a one-shot. And certainly not for a convention with a group of strangers. So this is something where I'm kind of having to learn the process myself, which...
I saw the description of your game. It looks very familiar.
Yeah, I'm drawing some of the plot ideas loosely from that campaign you guys had. The outcome will be very different, but I'm loosely drawing.
You mean the game's not going to end after
sessions? Well, actually it will. Well, after one session.
It'll end after one session. Hopefully it won't end with any internal group conflict, though, but...
Well, as for getting ready for it, I think you're on the right track. Not that I've run a ton of con games, but I do like to do them, I found out, because it lets me indulge a lot of the wacky ideas that wouldn't really work as a full-blown campaign, such as Heroes of History last time.
That was brilliant, by the way.
Well, thank you. I do appreciate that. And this next one's going to be, hopefully, just as good, if not better. I'm doing Savage Dukes of Hazzard as they fight off the minions of hell in Hazzard County. It's going to be a goldmine of car chases, hay bales, and exploding arrows.
See, these are comedy games, though.
That's not a comedy game. Why would that be a comedy game? Because the premise is high action with a combination of stuff?
There's a hazard.
Huh?
When you have the General Lee running shine to defeat the devil, I'm sorry, but you have a comedy game on your hands.
If you're looking at it,
when you have Reagan armed with super speed and Lincoln with a machine gun for one arm or whatever... You have.
But I'm not going for humor out of it. I'm going for action adventure with a quirky premise and quirky characters that people will instantly recognize and be able to get into the game very quickly with and have a niche, have a hook. Like, right. Oh, well, I'm Bo Duke. I'm on probation for an indefinite amount of time in Hazzard County. How do I defeat the devil?
It is a fast way to get people into character.
That's why I did Heroes of History. It's like, what can I do? Well, people know historical figures.
Well, let's start with that. One of the things you're dealing with is you have no idea who's going to sit down at the table. And
chances
are, unless you're doing some kind of like organized play event, they don't have a character you've ever seen ahead of time. Especially if this is a con. I mean, with Fear the Boot Con, okay, it's a con surrounding one community. But if you're going to like a Gen Con or something, you don't have that luxury. Six people sign up for your game. You have no idea who these six people are. You can't work on characters ahead of time. So let's start with the characters.
You pre-gen them, so you know exactly what you have at your table.
Yeah, you pre-gen them. You have to give them something they understand. I mean, you can't give them the super nuanced, detailed character that only makes sense to you. You've got to give them, and using historical figures or even archetypical characters, mm-hmm. I think, would help with that. And I think, though, you've got to give them something. I think Chris did a great job with the Skies of Glass cookout game, where with the characters, he gave them each a little bit of personality, a little bit of background, but it was enough that you knew kind of where the character was headed, but there was still broad room for personal interpretation. You could really personalize the character's execution, and then he would put one or two of these little oddities in with this character just to kind of see what you did with it. Like the character I played when we ran this recently, I had a pop-up book of the castles of Europe.
Gaming story.
And I never got a chance to use it, but the point is that, you know, there was one little quirk in there that gave me something to play with in this character.
Hey, he did a good job, and I think that that's a something that a lot of con GMs do, because while I've not run a ton of con games, I have played a lot of them, and usually that's what you get. You get the character on sheet on one side. On the back, you'll get your personality description, kind of role-playing hints, and a good GM gives you that so you can instantly go, okay, here's who I am, and here's what I have to go with here. And even sometimes the relationships with the other characters, which is also very helpful. Like, oh, I don't like such and such because of this. It instantly gives you reasons to interact with other people, which is what you should be doing. You should be setting people up so that they interact with each other and with the game. Not that they have to, like, the reason I've never run a Renegade Horizon one-shot or con game is because I think it'd take me too long to explain. The quirkiness is what makes it different and what makes it interesting, and that would take far too long to come across. It would take 15 minutes maybe, which isn't really that long, but in a con game, that's a lot of time.
Here's a question.
I'd really be jumping in.
Here's a question I'm going to throw to Joe, since you've run quite a few of these. When you hand people these characters and you do an organized play, they may even walk in with their own characters. You have no idea what the heck you're going to get or what these people are going to do with the game. What are some of the things that you have used to try and keep the games kind of on subject and generally moving in a productive direction?
Well, if you're dealing with pre-generated characters, the first thing you have to be prepared for is that whatever character you give them, and not just like character in terms of stat build, but the actual character of the person they're playing will be immediately polarized by anyone who is an active participant. You know, you have those people that just kind of sit there and wait for their turn to roll the dice. But the people that are actually going to speak to the other characters or speak to the NPCs are going to latch on to the few descriptive elements you provide for their character, and they're going to focus on that for the next 4 to 5 hours, however long your slot is, because that's all they know about their character. They haven't had the opportunity to really flesh that out for themselves. You know, some of them might not even be very good readers, so they might just read that one section and then just, you know, if someone doesn't like so-and-so, prepare for that person to hate the other person, because it's going to be taken to an extreme.
Good point.
So when you're crafting your adventure, you need to have your adventure accommodate that kind of polarity. Expect, I would actually recommend possibly either at least craft a rough outline of all your characters before your adventure, so that you can then account for their talents, their abilities, and their personality. Where it might be really easy for your mechanic to, you know, defuse a bomb at a door and then open the electronic lock, there might be some type of role play element that will take that easy die roll encounter and flush it out into a half hour, even an hour of role playing, just inter-party role playing, where you as the DM can just sit back and watch. So dealing first with your characters and last with your characters will give them the tools they need as players to really help run the game for you. The less work you do as a DM, typically the better your events are.
So are you almost suggesting that in some way it is best to let these be player-driven games, to have, I don't want to say minimal plot, but to have a very open or very flexible plot and just accept from the start you don't know what the players are going to do and just kind of let things fall where they may?
They need a roadmap to follow, but they don't need a railroad. Have a beginning, have an objective, have points that are most likely for them to take along the way. But remember, you have the great, great advantage of being the author as well as the DM, and the fact that that event never has to be played again. So you don't have to worry about fairness to other tables or any type of continuity. All you need to do is make sure that the 4 to 6 people that sit at your table have a really good time.
You're here.
Joe, could you give an example of what you're talking about there, the difference between giving them direction without railroading them? I mean, could you just throw out an example of maybe, you know, this is one that would work and this is one that goes too far?
Well, I'm going to be vague first, because I don't want to offer a specific example right away, because I want to clarify that 90% of your players will take the route you as the author will probably, if I should say, if you're a good author and you can really conceive of what people will probably do, they really will do it. And you could spend weeks and weeks crafting an adventure that has every conceivable contingent, and 90% of your players will always do the very first most obvious option. The key is, rather than pushing them into those options, letting them choose those options. you might not have actually provided any contingencies whatsoever, but because they got to make the choice, they feel like they have solved the adventure or completed the adventure of their own accord, which means you need to be prepared for that 10% that won't go that way. And that might be crafting contingencies ahead of time. It's good to be prepared, even if you're just giving yourself a selection of, you know, bullet points of, okay, if they don't do what I've prepared, here are some likely other things that might happen. But roll with whatever they do so that, you know, you have an objective that you give to them at the beginning. They need to complete that by the end. And you think they're going to take steps A, B, C, and D. And they do A and they do B. And all of a sudden they take a left turn and they skip to J. As the judge, you should not force them back to C and D. You should make the J their next step. And then, you know, they might not finish the adventure because they chose wrong. That might not even be important to them to finish, especially at something like Fear the Con. They're there to have you guys be their judge and have a lot of fun. Fun is the optimal word. It is more important for them to have a good time than it is for them to finish the adventure you created for them. So if going off on a tangent is fun for them, go with it. If it's fun for the one or two people that are pushing the group in that direction and the rest would rather kind of get back to the task at hand, sometimes you have to be more firm and say, well, what does the rest of the group want to be? Because it's very easy for one or two very vocal people to Shanghai your table. So you might have, and I'm going to go back to this locked door with the bomb, you might have expected them with the, you know, you've created the characters, so you know the mechanic has the ability to defuse the bomb and then unlock the electronic lock on the door. Instead, some other person says, wait a second, there's a duct up there. Why don't we crawl through there, go three rooms over, and then walk around? Oh, you didn't really plan for that, but there's no reason why they can't. Unless, you know, there's lasers or something, and then you say, well, you open it up and you see lasers. Maybe they'll think of a way to get around the lasers. You know, don't just say, no, that's not really going to work. No without either a but or a because is a very bad word to say to players.
I can't agree with that more. That's one of my GMing philosophies these days, especially after our Ruins campaign, where that was shown to me in great clarity as I screwed over Joe's character time again for absolutely no reason.
Endlessly.
Yeah, that was
endlessly.
That was my game of shame. I ran that horribly and so many points. But I actually have two points here. One about talking about general philosophy of game design. The whole topic tonight spawned from John and I were IMing, and he was talking about the game he was going to run. And he's like, well, at this point in the game, I don't know if I want to do this or this. What do you think? And I'm like, well, which would rock more? And he's like, what? I'm like, which one would rock more? He's like, well, this one would be a lot more fun. I'm like, we'll do that then. He's like, is that how you design all your adventures? I'm like, pretty much. I sit down and think, what would rock? And I go with that.
Well, I think like you're saying, especially for a con, because if you're playing a long campaign, then you might accept that in order to build depth or in order to build suspense or whatever, that there might be some games where you're kind of prologuing or hinting at things or building up to something, and then all of a sudden, you know, three or four games in, everyone's like, wow, this is really cool. I didn't see where this was headed, and we needed this backstory or whatever. But at a one-shotter at a con, I mean, you're absolutely right that the objective here is to send people home with a one-shot good experience.
The caveat to that, Dan, though, is do you really think this is going to be the only Fear the Boot con you ever have? You're probably going, you know, with your fan base, you're going to have a successful get together since it's only a day long, which means you'll get to do another one that might be 2 days or even 3 days. How badass of a GM would you be if you dropped seeds in your game this time? And when those people come back later, having played an entire event, thinking, wow, that was a really good time, I wonder what we're going to do next time. And all of a sudden they start noticing things that they saw before and that you, Mr. Maestro, had planned all this stuff a year ahead of time.
Yeah, I guess if...
That's a long plan time.
Yeah, I guess if you...
This guy does live in Greyhawk. That's how
well,
it works.
Well, I was going to say, you know, my fear, I guess, once again, having never done this,
is the boot
out of ignorance, is that will I get the same people back and will they remember the game? And I don't know. I mean, Joe, once again, maybe...
But then it doesn't matter. I mean, as long as those seeds aren't integral to the next adventure,
right,
it doesn't matter. You know, if it's just like, you know, if you see a good movie that was like, I saw the Transporter 2. I did not need to see Transporter 1 to understand that movie. Same thing. you lay your seeds, and if the same people are there, they're like, oh, wow, Dan rocks. If it's new people, they're like, oh, I don't know what that means, but Dan rocks.
So yeah. you're saying Dan's the paterfamilias. He spread his seed.
Ew. You have to get the family farm back first.
That's right, you do. Hey, we talking a little bit about philosophy, something Dan said a minute ago about the whole goal. Well, everybody's been saying the whole goal is to leave people entertained. When I was talking to Adam about this, that was my goal for game philosophy, is to do things that rock. My goal for the game as a whole is I want to run the game that people leave and talk about and make people feel ashamed that they weren't there. That's what I want. I want people to have such a good time that people are like, why wasn't I there? I missed Woodstock. It's basically what I want.
Do you do this at your eye care clinic too?
Yeah, well, I do this in everything I do. I mean, this is how I live my life.
Spritz morphine into people's eyes.
Whoa, I do not do that. Let's not get the board looking at me. I do not spritz any morphine or anything I shouldn't be in people's eyes, because I'm a good eye doctor. I had a second point earlier that we got off topic a bit about, but we were talking about specific examples of leaving things kind of open.
Right.
In my Heroes of History game, once they traveled back in time to Egypt, there was a huge army attacking the Egyptians that they could have gone and basically saved the Egyptians themselves and then tried to tackle the basically the leader who would have eventually come out after them. But what they decided to do? Hey, we've got a guitar-shaped rocket ship. Let's fly this. Let's fly this right
into the pyramid.
Yeah, let's fly right into the pyramid.
Games, right?
It's not a comedy game. It's just fun. I don't need labels.
I think that there is a big difference in topic there.
All right. Well, that's another show for another time, but I'm go on.
But they
had a guitar-shaped rocket ship going.
Well, this was early in the game. They got that. Boston linked it to them. It's from Boston. But they decided to fly right at the boss's pyramid, which had this big energy shield, but Ben Franklin can control electricity, so he wanted to try to bust it open. I said, well, yeah, why not? Go ahead. So they flew they flew into the pyramid, crash-landed, and went right for the big boss and had an epic battle at the end. And that was that. Good times. So, I mean, they had several choices and ones I didn't even see coming, but still roll with it. It's not, like Joe said, it's a roadmap, not a railroad.
I want to talk a little bit about setting, because this is one of the things that I think, and this may be uniquely my problem because of the game that I'm running.
I saw in your blurb that you're like, if you're in this game, PM me and I'll send you a document with a summary. And I was like,
I think that's a really bad idea.
Well, but it's like almost like I don't have a choice, because here's the thing. Like we were talking about earlier with characters, it's really easy to give people an archetype or a well-known persona that they can latch on to. You know, a character from Dukes of Hazzard, an ex-president of the United States, or even just the archetype of the mechanic. And it's something they can latch right on to. And the same is true of setting. That if you have a sword and sorcery sort of setting, or you were playing D&D or Star Trek or Star Wars, just something that most people are going to be at least conversationally familiar with, this works out really well. But in my case, I've been specifically asked to run a game that's in a highly detailed universe that I've developed, and I accept that for the case of the game, the 4 hours we're here to have fun, that I can't get too deep with that setting, because I'd spend the 4 hours with maps and racial diagrams lecturing on the background and we'd never get anywhere. But nonetheless, I have this very detailed setting that nobody is going to be even loosely fluent in, and that I've got to draw people into. And that's why the only idea I could come up with is, well, we'll keep it fairly shallow. We won't get really into the nitty gritty of the setting, but I may have to send you a 2 or 3 paragraph thing that just kind of explains the real basics of here's generally what technology's like, and here's generally what's going on in the universe.
Dude, I point to your advice from many and several shows, and that show, don't tell. You can, in the first 15 minutes of gameplay, you can show everything you need for your 4-hour session to get the basics of here's what this part of Danverse is about. This is what, any new game that has a demo at any convention starts out at the same place. We're very detailed, probably something different,
right.
And they have to introduce people to it. And I think having people read it is neither nearly as much fun nor as memorable as having them experience and drive it.
What you guys have been talking about, and you've kind of just gone about it in a really roundabout way, there are three types of con games. We talked about the first and the most prevalent. That's the extravaganza.
Ooh,
it's the one that
okay.
makes you go, oh, wow.
Yeah, I don't have...
Now you're getting into the exhibition. Exhibition is, here's my world. Welcome to my world. You still give them an adventure, but you don't put as much into it because they're going to be learning as they go. It's your job as the GM. And this is where blurbs are so important. If you want to run an exhibition game, you need to tell them it's an exhibition. that they're going to be learning as much as they're going to be playing.
That Adam isn't going to be wearing pants.
And very Adam isn't going to be wearing pants.
I may not be wearing pants at FairlyCon.
If they show up expecting an extravaganza and you give them the exhibition, you're going to tank. And you're going to tank hard. But if they know ahead of time that they're being introduced to a new setting and that that introduction is the primary goal of the event and that is what they receive, then, you know, it's their fault if they signed up and don't have fun.
So what I'm hearing here is probably by the time this episode drops, I'm going to have a new blurb up for my game.
I think so, too.
It's easy for me to edit.
I think exactly what he's saying. You kind of have to let your players know what to expect.
Yeah.
They're not going to be driving the General Lee in your game. That's for sure.
Exactly.
No,
I mean,
they will not be driving
the only thing that they have to reference the con games on that we, I mean, I say we, that Fear the Boot is going to run is Heroes of History, the only con game that has been run. And the way that we all talk about Heroes of History, it's completely different than the game that you're planning on running.
Right.
When you said blurb, Dan, there are really, to actual running an adventure at a convention, there are three components, and the actual adventure is only one of them. And frankly, out of the three, it's, in my opinion, actually the least important to have finished by the time the show comes around. The blurb and your preparation as a GM are the other two, and they're much more important. The blurb, and I'm going to use yours as an example, is what sells your event to the players. It's the only thing, the only information they have to go on for when they show up. It sets their expectations to begin with. So using your blurb as an example, it's very detailed. Not as big as John's, I'll give it. But where
well,
your
not many people are as big as John.
Yeah. Where your blurb suggests they start isn't the same place as where the role-playing seems to be suggested. And what I'm trying to get at, you tell them where they're starting, and then you tell them in the blurb what happens to them to get them to the action. So if that's the case, they already know the first hour of your adventure just from your blurb. You say, and it was really cool that you listed what type of character concepts you're going to be handing out. Very important with pre-generated characters. So that if they don't like any of those, you don't want people sitting down going, oh, I don't want to play this. Well, then go to a different table. But at the same time, they sit down, and then if you're going to run them through the here's your mission, you've already given them their mission in the blurb.
Right.
And then you've already told them things go wrong. So, you know, your first quarter of your adventure, they already know. And they're going to be bored going through it. The second half of your blurb was much more enticing. You know, there's action, intrigue, there's potential inner party intrigue. That by itself is a really good sales pitch for your adventure. Then you can still run them through the first quarter and they won't be bored.
Ooh, do mine next.
See, I know you don't want labels, but you're running a camp game. It still can be fun adventure, but people are going to come to it much like they did to Hackmaster. You know, it's meant to be taken as a comedy. Doesn't mean you can't have fun.
I'll take the camp label. I won't take the comedy. There will be comedy, but...
You'll accept silly, but you won't accept comedy.
Yeah, I'll accept silly, but not comedy.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, well, you're running a silly game.
Yeah, it's very lighthearted.
So really, your title, your title alone kind of just says, hey, Savage Dukes of Hazzard. That's most what anyone needs. The only thing that your blurb really does is tell them that you've actually conceived of a genuine adventure, and you're not just going to be goofing off going, woo, we're the Duke boys.
This is true.
A little bit early.
I actually read John's whole blurb, and wow. I have no comments on John's blurb because it's a small book.
Now, a little bit earlier, you said there were three types of games. You said there was the extravaganza, the exhibition. What's the third?
The third is the event or the recurring event, and that's what organized play is. You don't have to have as much of a wow factor because it can be leading up to a larger crescendo later. If every one of your organized play or your event adventures were wow, then that becomes the norm rather than the climax. So you mix it up with role-playing adventures, investigative adventures, mysteries. You know, you don't have to have the world in peril every single adventure. The good thing is, though, they all start with E, so they're really easy to remember.
The three E's of con gaming.
The three E's of con gaming.
There you go. All right, Joe, what about, here's getting into the nitty-gritty of adventure design. You have 4 hours. How do you balance that?
What is that? How long your guys' slot is?
Yes. Three. Yeah. We're shooting for 3:45 with a few minutes, a little break between each, but not much. I expect things
if
to go over.
If you shoot for 3:45, you're going to hit about 4.5. I'll just tell you that right now. No tables finish on time if the players are having fun, because no one wants to stop having fun. So you can tell an adventure. You can tell the quality of the adventure or the quality of the players based on when the adventure ends. If it ends early, that means either the GM did a bad job or you just ended up with that group of players that are there to kind of just knock out their next adventure as if it's some type of notch on a belt. I'm not one of those people, so I can never really explain the reasoning very well. But if you're having a good time, who wants that to end? So if you say 3:45, expect you as the con administrators to have to kick people out of their tables 45 minutes later. And really, while it's frustrating at the time, it's a true testament to the success of your your convention. If people are staying at the tables longer than they should.
Adam, to be honest, I already expected this one. I may be inexperienced with con gaming, but I'm very experienced with group organization in general, just making events work. And I'll say I was
this
kind
is
of,
precisely why I plan on playing no games and running no games.
I was already expecting this one, that we were going to have to kind of be clock Nazis at a couple points in the con just to keep
add to your
moving.
List an air horn.
Oh, no.
I don't need an air horn, babe.
All you got to do is bring in a mic and a speaker and create massive feedback. Like, it's everyone's attention.
I think there's a PA system, too.
Oh, really? Awesome. Oh, can I run my game over the PA system? I won't even be at the table. I'll just be the disembodied voice.
An entire con game. Fear the con original.
Wouldn't that be a LARP then, though?
No.
Or a dinner
Nobody
theater.
Nobody needs to stand up.
I guess it'd be like a dinner theater.
I think con game is cooler.
Oh.
All right, Joe, right. Pretend we have just 4 hours.
Yeah, to answer your question, you have your 4 hours. The first thing you as an author need to determine is what type of adventure you're going to run. Is it going to be role-playing focused, or is it going to be combat focused, or a blend of both? If you're going to have combat, you then have to decide what's the power level of your characters. Higher level combat takes much longer than lower level combat. So if you're going to have a role-playing adventure, this is wholly up to your players. If you get a group of people that are not role players or role play by rolling a die saying, I convinced them because I rolled a 20. They don't actually tell you what they're saying. Those adventures go really fast, but you can't plan for that. You have to plan for the people that talk a lot. You have to plan for having 6 Keith Curtises at your table.
I would love to game with 6 Keith Curtises. That would be a dream.
I just
that
want
guy's
Keith
awesome.
To run a game for me. That would be awesome.
Oh, I planned it. Like I said, I don't LARP, but I would LARP with him.
I just want him to sing Barbershop Quartet.
That picture was awesome, by the way, Keith.
I'm married and have no intention of getting divorced, but I'm also thinking about telling Carla we need to get divorced and remarried just so we can have Keith come and do our wedding.
That also would be
When's
awesome.
When's your anniversary?
December 9th.
Oh, well, get on the horn.
So we just...
December 9th?
I'm sorry, October 9th. By December 9th, man, I'm glad Carla doesn't listen to these episodes. October 9th.
She'll never know.
She'll
yeah,
none.
She will.
She'll be none the way out.
Someone will cut that out.
Adam will...
You are making the soundboard, right? That's perfect. My anniversary is December 9th.
And then we had to wait until Adam corrected him.
So, Joe.
So, if you have a role-playing adventure, you can expect 4 to 6 encounters, all you need to fill 4 hours. Then, you know, you have your introduction and just, you know, they can spend over an hour. My record is 3 hours and 45 minutes in one encounter. And I only ever answered their questions or responded to them in character. I never had to pull them anywhere. So role-playing adventures, it's all up to the players. They can make it as fun and as long as they want. Like if you have something where you're like, okay, I'm going to have these 8 encounters in a role-playing adventure, you're going to either have to make them stop role-playing, which is never fun, or you're just not going to be able to finish your adventure. So don't waste your time. Shoot for 6. It's a really good number. If you have a high-level combat, 6 is also a good number because one combat could take an hour, could take 4 hours depending on the kind of game you're running. Although 4-hour combats, if it's the same combat, never fun. Over an hour of combat is kind of taxing. If you're going to have...
You've never met Phil, I see.
I've never met Phil. I've heard stories, but I thought he was mythological.
Yeah.
I think it kind of is.
That's what it says on his magic card. Legendary.
That's right. High-level combats, you know, plan for 6. Otherwise, if you're going to have low-level combats or if you're going to have a blend, you can have anywhere between 6 to 10 encounters, I really shoot for 8. 8's a good solid number where you can come up just a little bit short or run a little bit long, but everyone should have a really good time.
And just to be clear here, by encounters, you're not talking about necessarily combat encounters. Am I correct?
Any instance where the party has to do something. Whether it's scouting, whether it's searching, whether it's talking to somebody, anytime they take the lead away from the GM, that's an encounter.
Right. I just wanted to make that clarification because there's been kind of a shift in the use of that word. Back in the older days of D&D, when the party encounters any obstacle, that's an encounter. And
I always associate it with combat.
Heck, even in some of the old like D&D gold box games, they had like, I don't know, it was 5 or 6 options like fight, parlay, sneak. I don't remember what they all
were. Back when Elf was a class, man, I am getting tired of hearing that.
But
seriously.
No, this was not one. This would have been after that.
It was gold box. It wasn't rules encyclopedia.
Yeah.
Whatever.
But anyway, the point being, though, that I just want to clarify that by encounter, we don't necessarily mean fight. We just mean the party has encountered something they must overcome. And that encounter could be a locked door. That encounter could be a beggar on the street. You know, it's not necessarily 6 orcs trying to kill them.
A locked door is an encounter? That's awesome.
Yeah, and that's the real challenge is if your encounter is only a locked door, that's a lame encounter.
Well, yeah.
No, that's awesome.
What if the door can talk?
I
that's
agree.
Even more awesome.
I know. I'm just throwing out examples. I agree with you. It's a pretty crappy encounter.
Why the hell am I not playing in the talking locked door campaign?
Dude, read more.
It's a short campaign.
Read more Douglas Adams, I guess. The happy door or whatever. Anyway. But, I mean, yeah, if your encounter's a locked door, I mean, that's just bad GMing, period. That's got nothing to do with con gaming. That's bad gaming anywhere, anyway, anyhow.
When I had said that there were 3 things to focus on, I focused on your blurbs. I cannot stress enough preparation. You need to be prepared more than you actually need to have your adventure fully written. Any seasoned DM can DM on the fly. So as long as you have your outline of your adventure, a lot of times that's good enough. But if you're not prepared for your players, that is just unacceptable for a convention event where they paid and where a lot of them traveled, and it just looks really bad on you. You need to be able to bring your A game as soon as they sit down.
I say, can you define prepared? Exactly what you mean by that.
You need to understand your adventure so that if they decide to go off the tracks, you can roll with that. You need to know where your adventure is going. You need to actually have thought of a conclusion. You need to have prepared their characters since you're giving them pre-generated characters, and you need to have the handouts printed. You don't want them looking over your shoulder while they read your laptop. You want to have all your dice, all the rules you need. You need to have actually read your adventure notes or your full adventure if you wrote it recently so that you don't forget it because work was really stressful that week. There needs to be absolutely no delay once the beginning of that slot begins and they sit down.
Yeah, I would also add on to that strong personality that when they sit down ready to go, you've got to be ready to stand up and take the lead. I mean, once you start the adventure, there's typically going to be someone at the table with a pretty strong personality who will kind of start pushing things around. But to at least get things started, you've got to come off strong, because if you don't come off strong, if you don't believe in yourself, neither is anyone else at the table. I guess this is another way of putting it. Once again,
this, smell the fear.
Yeah, this isn't just con gaming. I mean, this is any event. I just had to MC a wedding, and I've got everyone standing around, just yakking, doing whatever. And I had to get up there and basically, without saying "shut up and sit down," say "shut up and sit down," and get the event moving. And I expect the same thing at the game. That when I sit down and these people are ready to game, I've got to be prepared to stand up and take the reins and say, "All right. This is what's happening. This is where you are. Let's go."
At Festivus Con, as people were still milling about getting started, I believe I just yelled, "Heroes of History, assemble." And actually, people really did come to the table and get ready to go. That worked. Nice. And that worked well.
Do you guys have any Tefa Marshall for Fear the Con? Some person that's going to stand on a chair and say, "This event over here, this event over there."
I'll probably end up doing
yeah,
it.
I
like to yell
Adam.
At crowds.
I think it's going to be Adam. We just got to get a few beers in him, and he'll start yelling at strangers whether we can stop him.
Like
or
a worldwide wing nick.
Yeah, like that's going to be trouble too. Getting
well,
a few beers in you,
or at Archon yelling at Mr. Big Boobs. So
I love that guy.
Well, this has definitely given me some things to think about, and by the time this episode drops, I'm definitely going to have rewritten my blurb. So
the only problem with that is that All right, go ahead. Sorry.
Bitch, piss, and moan. So
there's no problem. I can paste it like that.
So anyway, Joe, I do want to thank you for coming in and giving us your insight on this. It's definitely been very helpful, very interesting. And as for the rest of you guys, we will catch you next time.
Later, folks.
This has been a production of Fear the Boot, copyright 2007, fully owned by its hosts. Our theme song was written and performed by Tim White. Listeners are free to use the show in any non-commercial endeavor, as long as credit is provided to feartheboot.com. You can find previous episodes and other resources at feartheboot.com.